Chapter 10. The Magician's Book. The invisible people feasted their guests royally. It was very funny to see the plates and dishes coming to the table and not to see anyone carrying them. It would have been funny even if they had moved along level with the floor, as you would expect things to do in invisible hands, but they didn't. They progressed up the long dining hall in a series of bounds or jumps. At the highest point of each jump, a dish would be about 15 feet up in the air. Then it would come down and stop quite suddenly about 3 feet from the floor. When the dish contained anything like soup or stew, the result was rather disastrous. "I'm beginning to feel very inquisitive about these people," whispered Eustace to Edmund. "Do you think they're human at all? More like huge grasshoppers or giant frogs, I should say." "It does look like it," said Edmund. "But don't put the idea of the grasshoppers into Lucy's head. She's not too keen on insects, especially big ones." The meal would have been pleasanter if it had not been so exceedingly messy, and also if the conversation had not consisted entirely of agreements. The invisible people agreed about everything. Indeed, most of their remarks were the sort it would not be easy to disagree with. "What I always say is, when a chap's hungry, he likes some victuals." Or, "Getting dark now. Always does at night." Or even, "Ah, you've come over the water. Powerful wet stuff, ain't it?" And Lucy could not help looking at the dark, yawning entrance to the foot of the staircase. She could see it from where she sat, and wondering what she would find when she went up those stairs the next morning. But it was a good meal otherwise, with mushroom soup, and boiled chickens, and hot boiled ham and gooseberries, red currants, curds, cream, milk, and mead. The others liked the mead, but Eustace was sorry afterwards that he had drunk any. When Lucy woke up the next morning, it was like waking up on the day of an examination, or a day when you're going to the dentist. It was a lovely morning, with bees buzzing in and out of her open window, and the lawn outside looking very like somewhere in England. She got up and dressed, and tried to talk and eat ordinarily at breakfast. Then, after being instructed by the chief voice about what she was to do upstairs, she bid good-bye to the others, said nothing, walked to the bottom of the stairs, and began going up them, without once looking back. It was quite light. That was one good thing. There was, indeed, a window straight ahead of her at the top of the first flight. As long as she was on that flight, she could hear the tick-tock, tick-tock of a grandfather clock in the hall below. Then she came to the landing, and had to turn to her left up the next flight. After that, she couldn't hear the clock any more. Now she had come to the top of the stairs. Lucy looked, and saw a long, wide passage with a large window at the far end. Apparently the passage ran the whole length of the house. It was carved and panelled and carpeted, and very many doors opened off it on each side. She stood still, and couldn't hear the squeak of a mouse, or the buzzing of a fly, or the swaying of a curtain, or anything, except the beating of her own heart. "The last doorway on the left," she said to herself. It did seem a bit hard that it should be the last. To reach it, she would have to walk past room after room, and in any room there might be the magician, asleep, or awake, or invisible, or even dead. But it wouldn't do to think about that. She set out on her journey. The carpet was so thick that her feet made no noise. "There's nothing whatever to be afraid of. Yet," Lucy told herself. And certainly it was a quiet, sunlit passage. Perhaps a bit too quiet. It would have been nicer if there had not been strange signs painted in scarlet on the doors. Twisty, complicated things, which obviously had a meaning. And it mightn't be a very nice meaning, either. It would have been nicer still if there weren't those masks hanging on the wall. Not that they were exactly ugly, or not so very ugly, but the empty eye holes did look queer. and if you let yourself, you would soon start imagining that the masks were doing things as soon as your back was turned to them. After about the sixth door, she got her first real fright. For 1 second, she felt almost certain that a wicked little bearded face had popped out of the wall and made a grimace at her. She forced herself to stop and look at it, and it was not a face at all. It was a little mirror, just the size and shape of her own face, with hair on the top of it and a beard hanging down from it, so that when you looked in the mirror, your own face fitted into the hair and beard, and it looked as if they belonged to you. "I just caught my own reflection with the tail of my eye as I went past," said Lucy to herself. "That was all it was. It's quite harmless." But she didn't like the look of her own face with that hair and beard, and went on. I don't know what the bearded glass was for, because I am not a magician. Before she reached the last door on the left, Lucy was beginning to wonder whether the corridor had grown longer since she began her journey, and whether this was part of the magic of the house. But she got to it at last, and the door was open. It was a large room with three big windows, and it was lined from floor to ceiling with books, more books than Lucy had ever seen before, tiny little books, fat and dumpy books, and books bigger than any church Bible you have ever seen, all bound in leather and smelling old and learned and magical. But she knew from her instructions that she need not bother about any of these, for the book, the magic book, was lying on a reading desk in the very middle of the room. She saw she would have to read it standing, and anyway there were no chairs, and also that she would have to stand with her back to the door while she read it. So at once she turned to shut the door. It wouldn't shut. Some people may disagree with Lucy about this, but I think she was quite right. She said she wouldn't have minded if she could have shut the door, but that it was unpleasant to have to stand in a place like that with an open doorway right behind your back. I should have felt just the same. But there was nothing else to be done. One thing that worried her a good deal was the size of the book. The chief voice had not been able to give her any idea whereabouts in the book the spell for making things visible came. He even seemed rather surprised at her asking. He expected her to begin at the beginning and go on till she came to it. Obviously, he had never thought that there was any other way of finding a place in a book. "But it might take me days and weeks," said Lucy, looking at the huge volume. "And I feel already as if I've been in this place for hours." She went up to the desk and laid her hand on the book. Her fingers tingled when she touched it, as if it were full of electricity. She tried to open it, but couldn't at first. This, however, was only because it was fastened by two leaden clasps, and when she had undone these, it opened easily enough. And what a book it was! It was written, not printed, written in a clear, even hand, with thick downstrokes and thin upstrokes, very large, easier than print, and so beautiful that Lucy stared at it for a whole minute and forgot about reading it. The paper was crisp and smooth, and a nice smell came from it, and in the margins and round the big coloured capital letters at the beginning of each spell there were pictures. There was no title page, or title. The spells began straight away, and at first there was nothing very important in them. They were cures for warts, by washing your hands in moonlight in a silver basin, and toothache, and cramp, and a spell for taking a swarm of bees. The picture of the man with toothache was so lifelike that it would have set your own teeth aching if you looked at it too long, and the golden bees which were dotted all round the fourth spell looked for a moment as if they were really flying. Lucy could hardly tear herself away from that first page, but when she turned over, the next was just as interesting. "But I must get on," she told herself. And on she went, for about 30 pages, which, if she could have remembered them, would have taught her how to find buried treasure, how to remember things forgotten, how to forget things you wanted to forget,
How to tell whether anyone was speaking the truth. How to call up, or prevent, wind, fog, snow, sleet, or rain. How to produce enchanted sleeps. And how to give a man an ass's head, as they did to poor Bottom. And the longer she read, the more wonderful and more real the pictures became. Then she came to a page which was such a blaze of pictures that one hardly noticed the writing. Hardly. But she did notice the first words. They were, "An infallible spell to make beautiful her that uttereth it beyond the lot of mortals." Lucy peered at the pictures with her face close to the page, and although they had seemed crowded and muddlesome before, she found she could now see them quite clearly. The first was a picture of a girl standing at a reading desk, reading in a huge book, and the girl was dressed exactly like Lucy. In the next picture, Lucy, for the girl in the picture was Lucy herself, was standing up with her mouth open and a rather terrible expression on her face, chanting or reciting something. In the third picture, the beauty beyond the lot of mortals had come to her. It was strange, considering how small the pictures had looked at first, that the Lucy in the picture now seemed quite as big as the real Lucy. And they looked into each other's eyes, and the real Lucy looked away after a few minutes because she was dazzled by the beauty of the other Lucy, though she could still see a sort of likeness to herself in that beautiful face. And now the pictures came crowding on her thick and fast. She saw herself throned on high at a great tournament in Calumen, and all the kings of the world fought because of her beauty. After that, it turned from tournaments to real wars, and all Narnia and Arkenland, Telmar and Calumen, Galmar and Terebinthia were laid waste with the fury of the kings and the dukes and the great lords who fought for her favour. Then it changed, and Lucy, still beautiful beyond the lot of mortals, was back in England. And Susan, who had always been the beauty of the family, came home from America. The Susan in the picture looked exactly like the real Susan, only plainer, and with a nasty expression. And Susan was jealous of the dazzling beauty of Lucy. But that didn't matter a bit, because no one cared anything about Susan now. "I will say the spell," said Lucy. "I don't care. I will." She said, "I don't care," because she had a strong feeling that she mustn't. But when she looked back at the opening words of the spell, there, in the middle of the writing, where she felt quite sure there had been no picture before, she found the great face of a lion, of the lion, Aslan himself staring into hers. It was painted such a bright gold that it seemed to be coming towards her out of the page, and indeed she never was quite sure afterwards that it hadn't really moved a little. At any rate, she knew the expression on his face quite well. He was growling, and you could see most of his teeth. She became horribly afraid, and turned over the page at once. A little later she came to a spell which would let you know what your friends thought about you. Now, Lucy had wanted very badly to try the other spell, the one that made you beautiful beyond the lot of mortals, so she felt that to make up for not having said it, she really would say this one. And all in a hurry, for fear her mind would change, she said the words. "Nothing will induce me to tell you what they were." Then she waited for something to happen. As nothing happened, she began looking at the pictures, and all at once she saw the very last thing she expected, a picture of a third-class carriage in a train, with two schoolgirls sitting in it. She knew them at once. They were Marjorie Preston and Anne Featherstone. Only now it was much more than a picture. It was alive. She could see the telegraph posts flicking past outside the window. Then, gradually, like when the radio is coming on, she could hear what they were saying. "Shall I see anything of you this term?" said Anne. "Or are you still going to be taken up with Lucy Pevensey?" "Don't know what you mean by taken up," said Marjorie. "Oh, yes, you do," said Anne. "You were crazy about her last term." "No, I wasn't," said Marjorie. "I've got more sense than that. Not a bad little kid in her way, but I was getting pretty tired of her before the end of term."
"Well, you jolly well won't have the chance any other term," shouted Lucy. "You two-faced little beast!"
But the sound of her own voice at once reminded her that she was talking to a picture, and that the real Marjorie was far away in another world.
"Well," said Lucy to herself, "I did think better of her than that, and I did all sorts of things for her last term, and I stuck to her when not many other girls would, and she knows it, too. And to Anne Featherstone, of all people! I wonder, are all my friends the same? There are lots of other pictures. No, I won't look at any more. I won't. I won't." And with a great effort she turned over the page, but not before a large, angry tear had splashed on it. On the next page she came to a spell for the refreshment of the spirit. The pictures were fewer here, but very beautiful, and what Lucy found herself reading was more like a story than a spell. It went on for 3 pages, and before she had read to the bottom of the page she had forgotten that she was reading at all. She was living in the story as if it were real, and all the pictures were real, too. When she had got to the 3rd page and come to the end, she said, "That is the loveliest story I've ever read, or ever shall read in my whole life. Oh, I wish I could have gone on reading it for 10 years. At least I'll read it over again." But here part of the magic of the book came into play. You couldn't turn back. The right-hand pages, the ones ahead, could be turned. The left-hand pages could not. "Oh, what a shame," said Lucy. "I did so want to read it again. Well, at least I must remember it. Let's see, it was about... Oh, dear, it's all fading away again. And even this last page is going blank. This is a very strange book. How can I have forgotten? It was about a cup and a sword and a tree and a green hill. I know that much. But I can't remember. And what shall I do?"
And she never could remember. And ever since that day, what Lucy means by a good story is a story which reminds her of the forgotten story in the magician's book. She turned on, and found to her surprise a page with no pictures at all, but the 1st words were, "A spell to make hidden things visible." She read it through to make sure of all the hard words, and then said it out loud. And she knew at once that it was working, because as she spoke, the colours came into the capital letters at the top of the page, and the pictures began appearing in the margins. It was like when you hold to the fire something written in invisible ink, and the writing gradually shows up. Only, instead of the dingy colour of lemon juice, which is the easiest invisible ink, this was all gold and blue and scarlet. They were odd pictures, and contained many figures that Lucy did not much like the look of. And then she thought, "I suppose I've made everything visible, and not only the thumpers. There might be lots of other invisible things hanging about at a place like this. I'm not sure that I want to see them all." At that moment she heard soft, heavy footfalls coming along the corridor behind her, and of course she remembered what she had been told about the magician walking in his bare feet and making no more noise than a cat. It is always better to turn round than to have anything creeping up behind your back. Lucy did so. Then her face lit up till, for a moment, but of course she didn't know it, she looked almost as beautiful as that other Lucy in the picture. And she ran forward with a little cry of delight and with her arms stretched out. For what stood in the doorway was Aslan himself, the lion, the highest of all high kings.
and he was solid and real and warm, and he let her kiss him and bury herself in his shining mane. And from the low, earthquake-like sound that came from inside him, Lucy even dared to think that he was purring.
"Oh, Aslan," said she, "it was kind of you to come."
"I have been here all the time," said he, "but you have just made me visible."
"Aslan," said Lucy, almost a little reproachfully, "don't make fun of me. As if anything I could do would make you visible."
"It did," said Aslan. "Do you think I wouldn't obey my own rules?"
After a little pause, he spoke again.
"Child," he said, "I think you have been eavesdropping."
"Eavesdropping?"
"You listened to what your two schoolfellows were saying about you."
"Oh, that. I never thought that was eavesdropping, Aslan. Wasn't it magic?"
"Spying on people by magic is the same as spying on them in any other way. And you have misjudged your friend. She is weak, but she loves you. She was afraid of the older girl, and said what she does not mean."
"I don't think I'll ever be able to forget what I heard her say."
"No, you won't."
"Oh, dear," said Lucy, "have I spoiled everything? Do you mean we could have gone on being friends if it hadn't been for this, and been really great friends, all our lives, perhaps, and now we never shall?"
"Child," said Aslan, "did I not explain to you once before that no one is ever told what would have happened?"
"Yes, Aslan, you did," said Lucy. "I'm sorry, but please—"
"Speak on, dear heart."
"Shall I ever be able to read that story again? The one I couldn't remember? Will you tell it to me, Aslan? Oh, do, do, do."
"Indeed, yes. I will tell it to you for years and years. But now, come. We must meet the master of this house."
Chapter 11. The Duffelpuds Made Happy. Lucy followed the great lion out into the passage, and at once she saw coming towards them an old man, barefoot, dressed in a red robe. His white hair was crowned with a chaplet of oak leaves. His beard fell to his girdle, and he supported himself with a curiously carved staff. When he saw Aslan, he bowed low and said, "Welcome, sir, to the least of your houses."
"Do you grow weary, Koryakin, of ruling such foolish subjects as I have given you here?"
"No," said the magician. "They are very stupid, but there is no real harm in them. I begin to grow rather fond of the creatures. Sometimes, perhaps, I am a little impatient, waiting for the day when they can be governed by wisdom instead of this rough magic."
"All in good time, Koryakin," said Aslan.
"Oh, yes, all in very good time, sir," was the answer. "Do you intend to show yourself to them?"
"Nay," said the lion, with a little half-growl that meant, Lucy thought, the same as a laugh. "I should frighten them out of their senses. Many stars will grow old and come to take their rest in islands before your people are ripe for that. And today, before sunset, I must visit Trumpkin the dwarf, where he sits in the castle of Caer Paravel, counting the days till his master Caspian comes home. I will tell him all your story, Lucy. Do not look so sad. We shall meet soon again."
"Please, Aslan," said Lucy, "what do you call soon?
I call all times soon, said Aslan,
and instantly he was vanished away, and Lucy was alone with the magician.
Gone, said he, and you and I quite crestfallen. It's always like that, you can't keep him. It's not as if he were a tame lion. And how did you enjoy my book?
Oh, parts of it very much indeed, said Lucy. Did you know I was there all the time?
Well, of course I knew, when I let the duffers make themselves invisible, that you would be coming along presently to take the spell off. I wasn't quite sure of the exact day, and I wasn't especially on the watch this morning. You see, they had made me invisible, too, and being invisible always makes me so sleepy. Oh, hey-ho! There, I'm yawning again.
Are you hungry?
Well, perhaps I am a little, said Lucy. I've no idea what the time is.
Come, said the magician. All times may be soon to Aslan, but in my home all hungry times are 1 o'clock.
He led her a little way down the passage and opened a door. Passing in, Lucy found herself in a pleasant room full of sunlight and flowers. The table was bare when they entered, but it was, of course, a magic table, and at a word from the old man, the tablecloth, silver plates, glasses, and food appeared.
"I hope that is what you would like," said he. "I have tried to give you food more like the food of your own land than perhaps you have had lately."
"It's lovely," said Lucy.
And so it was. An omelette, piping hot, cold lamb and green peas, a strawberry ice, lemon squash to drink with a meal, and a cup of chocolate to follow. But the magician himself drank only wine and ate only bread. There was nothing alarming about him, and Lucy and he were soon chatting away like old friends.
"When will the spell work?" asked Lucy. "Will the duffers be visible again at once?"
"Oh, yes, they're visible now. But they're probably all asleep still. They always take a rest in the middle of the day."
"And now that they're visible, are you going to let them off being ugly? Will you make them as they were before?"
"Well, that's a rather delicate question," said the magician. "You see, it's only they who think they were so nice to look at before. They say they've been uglified, but that isn't what I call it. Many people might say the change was for the better."
"Are they awfully conceited?"
"They are. Or at least the chief duffer is, and he's taught all the rest to be. They always believe every word he says."
"We'd noticed that," said Lucy.
"Yes, we'd get on better without him, in a way. Of course I could turn him into something else, or even put a spell on him which would make them not believe a word he said. But I don't like to do that. It's better for them to admire him than to admire nobody."
"Don't they admire you?" asked Lucy.
"Oh, not me," said the magician. "They wouldn't admire me."
"What was it you uglified them for? I mean, what they call uglified?"
"Well, they wouldn't do what they were told. Their work is to mind the garden and raise food. Not for me, as they imagine, but for themselves. They wouldn't do it at all if I didn't make them. And, of course, for a garden you want water. There is a beautiful spring about 1/2 mile away up the hill, and from that spring there flows a stream which comes right past the garden. All I asked them to do was to take their water from the stream instead of trudging up to the spring with their buckets 2 or 3 times a day and tiring themselves out, besides spilling 1/2 of it on the way back. But they wouldn't see it. In the end they refused, point blank."
"Are they as stupid as all that?" asked Lucy.
The magician sighed.
"You wouldn't believe the troubles I've had with them. A few months ago,
They were all for washing up the plates and knives before dinner. They said it saved time afterwards. I've caught them planting boiled potatoes to save cooking them when they were dug up. One day the cat got into the dairy and 20 of them were at work moving all the milk out. No one thought of moving the cat. But I see you finished. Let's go and look at the duffers now they can be looked at. They went into another room which was full of polished instruments, hard to understand, such as astrolabes, orreries, chronoscopes, posimeters, coriambuses, and theodolines. And here, when they had come to the window, the magician said, "There, there are your duffers." "I don't see anybody," said Lucy. "And what are those mushroom things?" The things she pointed at were dotted all over the level grass. They were certainly very like mushrooms, but far too big, the stalks about 3 feet high, and the umbrellas about the same length from edge to edge. When she looked carefully, she noticed, too, that the stalks joined the umbrellas not in the middle, but at one side, which gave an unbalanced look to them. And there was something, a sort of little bundle, lying on the grass at the foot of each stalk. In fact, the longer she gazed at them, the less like mushrooms they appeared. The umbrella part was not really round, as she had thought at first. It was longer than it was broad, and it widened at one end. There were a great many of them, 50 or more. The clock struck 3. Instantly, a most extraordinary thing happened. Each of the mushrooms suddenly turned upside down. The little bundles which had lain at the bottom of the stalks were heads and bodies. The stalks themselves were legs, but not 2 legs to each body. Each body had a single thick leg right under it, not to one side, like the leg of a one-legged man, and at the end of it a single enormous foot, a broad-toed foot, with the toes curling up a little, so that it looked rather like a small canoe. She saw in a moment why they had looked like mushrooms. They had been lying flat on their backs, each with its single leg straight up in the air, and its enormous foot spread out above it. She learned afterwards that this was their ordinary way of resting, for the foot kept off both rain and sun, and for a monopod to lie under its own foot is almost as good as being in a tent.
"Oh, the funnies! The funnies!" cried Lucy, bursting into laughter. "Did you make them like that?"
"Yes, yes, I made the duffers into monopods," said the magician. He too was laughing till the tears ran down his cheeks. "But watch," he added. It was worth watching. Of course, these little one-footed men couldn't walk or run as we do. They got about by jumping, like fleas or frogs, and what jumps they made! As if each big foot were a mass of springs, and with what a bounce they came down! That was what made the thumping noise which had so puzzled Lucy yesterday. But now they were jumping in all directions and calling out to one another,
"Hey, lads, we're visible again!"
"Visible we are," said one, in a tasselled red cap, who was obviously the chief monopod. "And what I say is, when chaps are visible, why, they can see one another."
"Ah, there it is, chief," cried all the others. "There's the point. No one's got a clearer head than you. You couldn't have made it plainer."
"She caught the old man napping, that little girl did," said the chief monopod.
"We've beaten him this time." "Just what we were going to say ourselves," chimed the chorus. "You're going stronger than ever today, chief. Keep it up, keep it up."
"But do they dare to talk about you like that?" said Lucy. "They seemed to be so afraid of you yesterday. Don't they know you might be listening?"
"That's one of the funny things about the duffers," said the magician. "One minute they talk as if I ran everything and overheard everything and was extremely dangerous. The next moment they think they can take me in by tricks that a baby would see through. Bless them!"
"Will they have to be turned back into their proper shapes?" asked Lucy.
Oh, I do hope it wouldn't be unkind to leave them as they are. Do they really mind very much? They seem pretty happy. I say, look at that jump! What were they like before?
Common little dwarfs, said he. Nothing like so nice as the sort you have in Narnia.
It would be a pity to change them back, said Lucy. They're so funny, and they're rather nice. Do you think it would make any difference if I told them that?
I'm sure it would, if you could get it into their heads.
Will you come with me and try?
No, no, you'll get on far better without me.
Thanks awfully for the lunch, said Lucy, and turned quickly away. She ran down the stairs, which she had come up so nervously that morning, and cannoned into Edmund at the bottom. All the others were there with him, waiting, and Lucy's conscience smote her when she saw their anxious faces, and realized how long she had forgotten them. "It's all right!" she shouted. "Everything's all right. The magician's a brick, and I've seen him, Aslan." After that, she went from them like the wind and out into the garden. Here the earth was shaking with the jumps, and the air ringing with the shouts of the monopods. Both were redoubled when they caught sight of her. "Here she comes! Here she comes!" they cried. "Three cheers for the little girl! Ah, she put it across the old gentleman properly, she did!" "And we're extremely regrettable," said the chief monopod, "that we can't give you the pleasure of seeing us as we were before we were uglified. For you wouldn't believe the difference, and that's the truth, for there's no denying we're mortal ugly now, so we won't deceive you." "Aye, that we are, chief, that we are!" echoed the others, bouncing like so many toy balloons. "You've said it, you've said it!" "But I don't think you are at all," said Lucy, shouting to make herself heard. "I think you look very nice." "Hear her, hear her!" said the monopods. "True for you, missy. Very nice we look. You couldn't find a handsomer lot." They said this without any surprise, and did not seem to notice that they had changed their minds. "She's a-saying," remarked the chief monopod, "as how we look very nice before we were uglified." "True for you, chief, true for you!" chanted the others. "That's what she says. We heard her ourselves." "I did not!" bawled Lucy. "I said you're very nice now!" "So she did, so she did," said the chief monopod. "Said we were very nice then." "Hear 'em both, hear 'em both!" said the monopods. "There's a pair for you, always right. They couldn't have put it better." "But we're saying just the opposite!" said Lucy, stamping her foot with impatience. "So you are, to be sure, so you are!" said the monopods. "Nothing like an opposite. Keep it up, both of you." "You are enough to drive anyone mad," said Lucy, and gave it up. But the monopods seemed perfectly contented, and she decided that on the whole the conversation had been a success. And before everyone went to bed that evening, something else happened, which made them even more satisfied with their one-legged condition. Caspian and all the Narnians went back as soon as possible to the shore to give their news to Rince and the others on board the Dawn Treader, who were by now very anxious. And, of course, the monopods went with them, bouncing like footballs and agreeing with one another in loud voices, till Eustace said, "I wish the magician would make them inaudible instead of invisible." He was soon sorry he had spoken, because then he had to explain that an inaudible thing is something you can't hear. And though he took a lot of trouble, he never felt sure that the monopods had really understood. And what especially annoyed him was that they said in the end, "Hey, he can't put things the way our chief does. But you learn, young man. Hark to him. He'll show you how to say things. There's a speaker for you." When they reached the bay, Reepy Cheep had a brilliant idea. He had his little coracle lowered and paddled himself about in it till the monopods were thoroughly interested. He then stood up in it and said, "Worthy and intelligent monopods, you do not need boats. Each of you has a foot that will do instead. Just jump as lightly as you can on the water and see what happens." The chief monopod hung back and warned the others that they'd find the water powerful wet. But one or two of the younger ones tried it almost at once, and then a few others followed their example, and at last the whole lot did the same. It worked perfectly. The huge single foot of a monopod acted as a natural raft or boat, and when Rippy-Cheep had taught them how to cut rude paddles for themselves, they all paddled about the bay and round the Dawn Treader, looking for all the world like a fleet of little canoes, with a fat dwarf standing up in the extreme stern of each. And they had races, and bottles of wine were lowered down to them from the ship as prizes, and the sailors stood leaning over the ship's side and laughed till their own sides ached. The Duffers were also very pleased with their new name of Monopods, which seemed to them a magnificent name, though they never got it right.
"That's what we are!" they bellowed. "Moneypads! Bobbinods! Bodymons! Just what it was on the tips of our tongues to call ourselves!"
But they soon got it mixed up with their old name of Duffers, and finally settled down to calling themselves the Duffelpuds. And that is what they will probably be called for centuries. That evening, all the Narnians dined upstairs with the magician, and Lucy noticed how different the whole top floor looked, now that she was no longer afraid of it. The mysterious signs on the doors were still mysterious, but now looked as if they had kind and cheerful meanings, and even the bearded mirror now seemed funny rather than frightening. At dinner, everyone had, by magic, what everyone liked best to eat and drink, and after dinner the magician did a very useful and beautiful piece of magic. He laid two blank sheets of parchment on the table and asked Drinian to give him an exact account of their voyage up to date. And as Drinian spoke, everything he described came out on the parchment, in fine, clear lines, till at last each sheet was a splendid map of the Eastern Ocean, showing Galma, Terebinthia, the Seven Isles, the Lone Islands, Dragon Island, Burnt Island, Death Water, and the land of the Duffers itself, all exactly the right sizes and in the right positions. They were the first maps ever made of those seas, and better than any that have been made since without magic. For on these, though the towns and mountains looked at first just as they would on an ordinary map, when the magician lent them a magnifying glass, you saw that they were perfect little pictures of the real things, so that you could see the very castle and slave market and streets in Narrowhaven, all very clear, though very distant, like things seen through the wrong end of a telescope. The only drawback was that the coastline of most of the islands was incomplete, for the map showed only what Drinian had seen with his own eyes. When they were finished, the magician kept one himself and presented the other to Caspian. It still hangs in his chamber of instruments at Caer Paravel. But the magician could tell them nothing about seas or lands further east. He did, however, tell them that about 7 years before a Narnian ship had put in at his waters, and that she had on board the lords Rebilion, Argos, Mavramorn, and Roop. So they judged that the golden man they had seen lying in Deathwater must be the Lord Restimar. Next day the magician magically mended the stern of the Dawn Treader, where it had been damaged by the sea serpent, and loaded her with useful gifts. There was a most friendly parting, and when she sailed, 2 hours after noon, all the Duffelpuds paddled out with her to the harbour mouth, and cheered until she was out of sound of their cheering. Chapter 12. The Dark Island. After this adventure, they sailed on south and a little east for 12 days, with a gentle wind, the skies being mostly clear and the air warm, and saw no bird or fish, except that once there were whales spouting a long way to starboard. Lucy and Rippy-Cheep played a good deal of chess at this time. Then, on the 13th day, Edmund, from the fighting top, sighted what looked like a great dark mountain, rising out of the sea on their port bow. They altered course and made for this land, mostly by oar, for the wind would not serve them to sail northeast. When evening fell, they were still a long way from it and rowed all night. The next morning the weather was fair, but a flat calm prevailed. The dark mass lay ahead, much nearer and larger, but still very dim, so that some thought it was still a long way off, and others thought they were running into a mist. About 9 that morning, very suddenly, it was so close that they could see that it was not land at all, nor, even in an ordinary sense, a mist. It was a darkness. It is rather hard to describe, but you will see what it was like if you imagine yourself looking into the mouth of a railway tunnel, a tunnel either so long or so twisty that you cannot see the light at the far end. And you know what it would be like. For a few feet you would see the rails and sleepers and gravel in broad daylight. Then there would come a place where they were in twilight, and then, pretty suddenly, but of course without a sharp dividing line, they would vanish altogether into smooth, solid blackness. It was just so here. For a few feet in front of their bows they could see the swell of the bright greenish-blue water. Beyond that they could see the water looking pale and grey, as it would look late in the evening. But beyond that again, utter blackness, as if they had come to the edge of moonless and starless night. Caspian shouted to the boatswain to keep her back, and all except the rowers rushed forward and gazed from the bows. But there was nothing to be seen by gazing. Behind them was the sea and the sun, before them the darkness. "Do we go into this?" asked Caspian at length.
"Not by my advice," said Drinian.
"The captain's right," said several sailors. "I almost think he is," said Edmund. Lucy and Eustace didn't speak, but they felt very glad inside at the turn things seemed to be taking. But all at once the clear voice of Weepy Cheep broke in upon the silence.
"And why not?" he said. "Will someone explain to me why not?"
No one was anxious to explain, so Weepy Cheep continued.
"If I were addressing peasants or slaves," he said, "I might suppose that this suggestion proceeded from cowardice. But I hope it will never be told in Narnia that a company of noble and royal persons in the flower of their age turned tail because they were afraid of the dark."
"But what manner of use would it be, ploughing through that blackness?" asked Drinian.
"Use," replied Weepy Cheep. "Use, Captain! If by use you mean filling our bellies or our purses, I confess it will be no use at all. So far as I know, we did not set sail to look for things useful, but to seek honour and adventure. And here is as great an adventure as ever I heard of, and here, if we turn back, no little impeachment of all our honours."
Several of the sailors said things under their breath that sounded like, "Honour be blowed." But Caspian said,
"Oh, bother you, Weepy Cheep. I almost wish we'd left you at home. All right, if you put it that way. I suppose we shall have to go on. Unless Lucy would rather not."
Lucy felt that she would very much rather not. But what she said out loud was,
"I'm game."
"Your Majesty would at least order lights," said Drinian.
"By all means," said Caspian. "See to it, Captain." So the three lanterns at the stern and the prow and the masthead were all lit, and Drinian ordered two torches amidships. Pale and feeble they looked in the sunshine. Then all the men, except some who were left below at the oars, were ordered on deck, and fully armed, and posted in their battle stations with swords drawn. Lucy and two archers were posted on the fighting top with bows bent and arrows on the string. Reinulf was in the bows with his line ready to take sounding. Weepy Cheep, Edmund, Eustace and Caspian, glittering in mail, were with him. Drinian took the tiller.
"And now, in Aslan's name, forward," cried Caspian. "A slow, steady stroke, and let every man be silent and keep his ears open for orders." With a creak and a groan, the Dawn Treader started to creep forward as the men began to row. Lucy, up in the fighting top, had a wonderful view of the exact moment at which they entered the darkness. The bows had already disappeared before the sunlight had left the stern. She saw it go. At one minute the gilded stern, the blue sea and the sky were all in broad daylight. Next minute the sea and sky had vanished. The stern lantern, which had been hardly noticeable before, was the only thing to show where the ship ended. In front of the lantern she could see the black shape of Drinian crouching at the tiller. Down below her the two torches made visible two small patches of deck and gleamed on swords and helmets, and forward there was another island of light on the forecastle. Apart from that, the fighting top, lit by the masthead light which was only just above her, seemed to be a little lighted world of its own, floating in lonely darkness. And the lights themselves, as always happens with lights when you have to have them at the wrong time of day, looked lurid and unnatural. She also noticed that she was very cold. How long this voyage into the darkness lasted, nobody knew. Except for the creak of the rowlocks and the splash of the oars, there was nothing to show that they were moving at all. Edmund, peering from the bows, could see nothing except the reflection of the lantern in the water before him. It looked a greasy sort of reflection, and the ripple, made by their advancing prow, appeared to be heavy, small, and lifeless. As time went on, everyone except the rowers began to shiver with cold. Suddenly, from somewhere, no one's sense of direction was very clear by now, there came a cry, either of some inhuman voice, or else a voice of one in such extremity of terror that he had almost lost his humanity. Caspian was still trying to speak, his mouth was too dry, when the shrill voice of Reepicheep, which sounded louder than usual in that silence, was heard.
"Who calls?" it piped. "If you are a foe, we do not fear you, and if you are a friend, your enemies shall be taught the fear of us."
"Mercy!" cried the voice. "Mercy! Even if you are only one dream, have mercy. Take me on board. Take me, even if you strike me dead. But in the name of all mercies, do not fade away and leave me in this horrible land."
"Where are you?" shouted Caspian. "Come aboard and welcome."
There came another cry, whether of joy or terror, and then they knew that someone was swimming towards them.
"Stand by to heave him up, men," said Caspian.
"Aye, aye, your Majesty," said the sailors.
Several crowded to the port bulwark with ropes, and one, leaning far out over the side, held the torch. A wild, white face appeared in the blackness of the water, and then, after some scrambling and pulling, a dozen friendly hands had heaved the stranger on board. Edmund thought he had never seen a wilder-looking man. Though he did not otherwise look very old, his hair was an untidy mop of white, his face was thin and drawn, and for clothing only a few wet rags hung about him. But what one mainly noticed were his eyes, which were so widely opened that he seemed to have no eyelids at all, and stared as if in an agony of pure fear. The moment his feet reached the deck, he said,
"Fly! Fly! About with your ship and fly! Row, row, row for your lives away from this cursed shore!"
"Compose yourself," said Reepicheep, "and tell us what the danger is. We are not used to flying."
The stranger started horribly at the voice of the mouse, which he had not noticed before.
"Nevertheless, you will fly from here," he gasped. "This is the island where dreams come true."
"That's the island I've been looking for this long time," said one of the sailors. "I reckon I'd find I was married to Nancy if we landed here."
"And I'd find Tom alive again," said another.
"Fools!" said the man, stamping his foot with rage. "That is the sort of talk that brought me here, and I'd better have been drowned or never born. Do you hear what I say? This is where dreams, do you understand, come to life, come real, not daydreams, dreams!" There was about half a minute's silence, and then, with a great clatter of armour, the whole crew were tumbling down the main hatch as quick as they could, and flinging themselves on the oars, to row as they had never rowed before. And Drinian was swinging round the tiller, and the boatswain was giving out the quickest stroke that ever had been heard at sea, for it had taken everyone just that half minute to remember certain dreams they had had, dreams that make you afraid of going to sleep again, and to realise what it would mean to land on a country where dreams come true. Only Rinkinchip remained unmoved.
"Your Majesty, Your Majesty," he said, "are you going to tolerate this mutiny, this poltroonery? This is a panic, this is a rout."
"Row, row," bellowed Caspian. "Pull for all our lives. Is our head right, Drinian? You can say what you like, Rinkinchip. There are some things no man can face."
"It is then my good fortune not to be a man," replied Rinkinchip, with a very stiff bow.
Lucy, from up aloft, had heard it all. In an instant, one of her own dreams, which she had tried hardest to forget, came back to her, as vividly as if she had only just woken from it. So that was what was behind them, on the island in the darkness. For a second she wanted to go down to the deck and be with Edmund and Caspian. But what was the use? If dreams began coming true, Edmund and Caspian themselves might turn into something horrible just as she reached them. She gripped the rail of the fighting top and tried to steady herself. They were rowing back to the light as hard as they could. It would be all right in a few seconds, but oh, if only it could be all right now! Though the rowing made a good deal of noise, it did not quite conceal the total silence which surrounded the ship. Everyone knew it would be better not to listen, not to strain his ears for any sound from the darkness. But no one could help listening, and soon everyone was hearing things. Each one heard something different.
"Do you hear a noise like a huge pair of scissors opening and shutting? Over there?"
Eustace asked Reinelf. "Hush," said Reinelf. "I can hear them crawling up the sides of the ship."
"It's just going to settle on the mast," said Caspian.
"Oh," said a sailor. "There are the gongs beginning anew, they would."
Caspian, trying not to look at anything, especially not to keep looking behind him, went aft to Drinian.
"Drinian," he said in a very low voice, "how long did we take rowing in? I mean, rowing to where we picked up the stranger?"
5 minutes, perhaps," whispered Drinian. "Why?"
"Because we've been more than that already, trying to get out."
Drinian's hand shook on the tiller, and a line of cold sweat ran down his face. The same idea was occurring to everyone on board.
"We shall never get out, never get out," moaned the rowers. "He's steering us wrong. We're going round and round in circles. We shall never get out."
The stranger, who had been lying in a huddled heap on the deck, sat up and burst out into a horrible screaming laugh.
"Never get out," he yelled. "That's it. Of course, we shall never get out. What a fool I was to have thought they would let me go as easily as that. No, no, we shall never get out."
Lucy leant her head on the edge of the fighting top and whispered,
"Aslan, Aslan, if ever you loved us at all, send us help now."
The darkness did not grow any less, but she began to feel a little, a very, very little better.
"After all, nothing has really happened to us yet," she thought.
"Look!"
cried Ryanulf's voice hoarsely from the bows. There was a tiny speck of light ahead, and while they watched, a broad beam of light fell from it upon the ship. It did not alter the surrounding darkness, but the whole ship
was lit up as if by searchlight. Caspian blinked, stared round, saw the faces of his companions, all with wild, fixed expressions. Everyone was staring in the same direction. Behind everyone lay his black, sharply edged shadow. Lucy looked along the beam and presently saw something in it. At first it looked like a cross. Then it looked like an aeroplane. Then it looked like a kite. And at last, with a whirring of wings, it was right overhead and was an albatross. It circled three times round the mast and then perched for an instant on the crest of the gilded dragon at the prow. It called out in a strong, sweet voice what seemed to be words, though no one understood them. After that, it spread its wings, rose, and began to fly slowly ahead, bearing a little to starboard. Drinian steered after it, not doubting that it offered good guidance. But no one except Lucy knew that as it circled the mast, it had whispered to her, "Courage, dear heart." And the voice she felt sure was Aslan's, and with the voice a delicious smell breathed in her face. In a few moments the darkness turned into a greyness ahead, and then, almost before they dared begin hoping, they had shot out into the sunlight and were in the warm blue world again. And all at once everybody realized that there was nothing to be afraid of, and never had been. They blinked their eyes and looked about them. The brightness of the ship herself astonished them. They had half expected to find that the darkness would cling to the white and the green and the gold in the form of some grime or scum. And then, first one and then another, began laughing.
"I reckon we've made pretty good fools of ourselves," said Reinulf.
Lucy lost no time in coming down to the deck, where she found the others all gathered round the newcomer. For a long time he was too happy to speak, and could only gaze at the sea and the sun and feel the bulwarks and the ropes, as if to make sure he was really awake, while tears rolled down his cheeks.
"Thank you," he said at last. "You have saved me from... But I won't talk of that. And now let me know who you are."
"I am a Telmarine of Narnia, and when I was worth anything, men called me the Lord Roop."
"And I," said Caspian, "am Caspian, King of Narnia, and I sail to find you and your companions, who were my father's friends." Lord Roop fell on his knees and kissed the king's hand.
"Sire," he said, "you are the man in all the world I most wish to see. Grant me a boon."
"What is it?" asked Caspian.
"Never to bring me back there," he said.
He pointed astern. They all looked, but they saw only bright blue sea and bright blue sky. The dark island and the darkness had vanished for ever.
"Why," cried Lord Roop, "you have destroyed it!"
"I don't think it was us," said Lucy.
"Sire," said Drinian, "this wind is fair for the southeast. Shall I have our poor fellows up and set sail? And after that, every man who can be spared to his hammock."
"Yes," said Caspian, "and let there be grog all round."
"Hey-ho! I feel I could sleep the clock round myself."
So, all afternoon, with great joy, they sailed southeast with a fair wind. But nobody noticed when the albatross had disappeared. Chapter 13. The Three Sleepers. The wind never failed, but it grew gentler every day, till at length the waves were little more than ripples, and the ship glided on hour after hour, almost as if they were sailing on a lake. And every night they saw that there rose in the east new constellations, which no one had ever seen in Narnia, and perhaps, as Lucy thought, with a mixture of joy and fear, no living eye had seen at all. Those new stars were big and bright, and the nights were warm. Most of them slept on deck and talked far into the night, or hung over the ship's side, watching the luminous dance of the foam thrown up by their bows. On an evening of startling beauty, when the sunset behind them was so crimson and purple and widely spread that the very sky itself seemed to have grown larger, they came in sight of land on their starboard bow. It came slowly nearer, and the light behind them made it look as if the capes and headlands of this new country were all on fire. But presently they were sailing along its coast, and its western cape now rose up astern of them, black against the red sky, and sharp as if it was cut out of cardboard. And then they could see better what this country was like. It had no mountains, but many gentle hills, with slopes like pillows. An attractive smell came from it, what Lucy called a dim, purple kind of smell, which Edmund said, and Rince thought, was rot. But Caspian said, "I know what you mean." They sailed on a good way, past point after point, hoping to find a nice deep harbour, but had to content themselves in the end with a wide and shallow bay. Though it had seemed calm out at sea, there was, of course, surf breaking on the sand, and they could not bring the Dawn Treader as far in as they would have liked. They dropped anchor a good way away from the beach, and had a wet and tumbling landing in the boat. The Lord Roop remained on board the Dawn Treader. He wished to see no more islands. All the time that they remained in this country, the sound of the long breakers was in their ears. Two men were left to guard the boat, and Caspian led the others inland. But not far, because it was too late for exploring, and the light would soon go. But there was no need to go far to find an adventure. The level valley which lay at the head of the bay showed no road or track or other sign of habitation. Underfoot was fine springy turf, dotted here and there with a low bushy growth which Edmund and Lucy took for heather. Eustace, who was really rather good at botany, said it wasn't, and he was probably right. But it was something of very much the same kind. When they had gone less than a bowshot from the shore, Drinian said,
"Look! What's that?"
And everyone stopped. "Are they great trees?" said Caspian.
"Towers, I think," said Eustace.
"It might be giants," said Edmund in a lower voice.
"The way to find out is to go right in among them," said Reepy Cheep,
drawing his sword and pattering off ahead of everyone else.
"I think it's a ruin," said Lucy, when they had got a good deal nearer, and her guess was the best so far. What they now saw was a wide, oblong space, flagged with smooth stones and surrounded by grey pillars, but unroofed, and from end to end of it ran a long table, laid with a rich crimson cloth that came down nearly to the pavement. At either side of it were many chairs of stone, richly carved, and with silken cushions upon the seats. But on the table itself there was set out such a banquet as had never been seen, not even when Peter, the High King, kept his court at Caer Paribel. There were turkeys and geese and peacocks. There were boar's heads and sides of venison. There were pies shaped like ships under full sail, or like dragons and elephants. There were ice puddings and bright lobsters and gleaming salmon. There were nuts and grapes, pineapples and peaches, pomegranates and melons and tomatoes. There were flagons of gold and silver, and curiously wrought glass. And the smell of the fruit and the wine blew towards them like a promise of all happiness. "I say!" said Lucy.
They came nearer and nearer, all very quietly.
"But where are the guests?"
asked Eustace.
"We can provide that, sir," said Rince. "Look!" said Edmund sharply.
They were actually within the pillars now, and standing on the pavement. Everyone looked where Edmund had pointed. The chairs were not all empty. At the head of the table, and in the two places beside it, there was something, or possibly three somethings.
"What are those?" asked Lucy in a whisper. "It looks like three beavers sitting on the table."
"Or a huge bird's nest," said Edmund.
"It looks more like a haystack to me," said Caspian.
Reepy Cheep ran forward, jumped on a chair and thence onto the table, and ran along it, threading his way as nimbly as a dancer between jewelled cups and pyramids of fruit and ivory salt cellars. He ran right up to the mysterious grey mass at the end, peered, touched, and then called out,
"These will not fight, I think."
Everyone now came close, and saw that what sat in those three chairs was three men,
though hard to recognise as men till you look closely. Their hair, which was grey, had grown over their eyes, till it almost concealed their faces, and their beards had grown over the table, climbing round and entwining plates and goblets as brambles entwine a fence, until, all mixed in one great mat of hair, they flowed over the edge and down to the floor. And from their heads, their hair hung over the backs of their chairs, so that they were wholly hidden. In fact, the three men were nearly all hair.
"Dead?" said Caspian.
"I think not, sire,"
said Reepy Cheep, lifting one of their hands out of its tangle of hair in his two paws.
"This one is warm, and his pulse beats."
"This one, too, and this," said Drinian.
"Why, they're only asleep," said Eustace.
"It's been a long sleep, though," said Edmund, "to let their hair grow like this."
"It must be an enchanted sleep," said Lucy. "I felt the moment we landed on this island that it was full of magic. Oh, do you think we have perhaps come here to break it?"
"We can try," said Caspian, and began shaking the nearest of the three sleepers. For a moment, everyone thought he was going to be successful, for the man breathed hard and muttered,
"I'll go eastward no more. Out oars for Narnia."
But he sank back almost at once into a yet deeper sleep than before. That is, his heavy head sagged a few inches lower towards the table, and all efforts to rouse him again were useless. With the second, it was much the same.
"Weren't born to live like animals. Get to the east while you've a chance. Lands behind the sun."
And sank down.
And the third only said,
"Mustard, please,"
and slept hard.
"Out oars for Narnia, eh?"
said Drinian.
"Yes," said Caspian. "You are right, Drinian. I think our quest is at an end. Let's look at their rings. Yes, these are their devices. This is the Lord Rebellion. This is the Lord Argos, and this the Lord Mavramorn."
"But we can't wake them," said Lucy. "What are we to do?"
"Begging your Majesty's pardons all," said Rince, "but why not fall to while you're discussing it? We don't see a dinner like this every day."
"Not for your life," said Caspian.
"That's right, that's right," said several of the sailors. "Too much magic about here. The sooner we're back on board, the better."
"Depend upon it," said Reepy Cheep, "it was from eating this food that these three lords came by a 7 years' sleep."
"I wouldn't touch it to save my life," said Drinian.
"The light's going uncommon quick," said Rhynelf. "Back to ship, back to ship," muttered the men.
"I really think," said Edmund, "they're right. We can decide what to do with the three sleepers tomorrow. We daren't eat the food, and there's no point in staying here for the night. The whole place smells of magic and danger."
"I am entirely of King Edmund's opinion," said Reepy Cheep, "as far as concerns the ship's company in general. But I myself will sit at this table till sunrise."
"Why on earth?" said Eustace.
"Because,"
said the Mouse,
"this is a very great adventure, and no danger seems to me so great as that of knowing when I get back to Narnia that I left a mystery behind me through fear."
"I'll stay with you, Reep," said Edmund,
"'And I, too,' said Caspian.
"'And me,' said Lucy.
"'And then Eustace volunteered also. "'This was very brave of him, "'because never having read of such things, "'or even heard of them, "'till he joined the Dawn Treader, "'made it worse for him than for the others.
"'I beseech your Majesty,' began Drinian.
"'No, my lord,' said Caspian. "'Your place is with the ship.' And you have had a day's work while we five have idled. There was a lot of argument about this, but in the end Caspian had his way. As the crew marched off to the shore in the gathering dusk, none of the five watchers, except perhaps Reepicheep, could avoid a cold feeling in the stomach.